This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, who leaked the name of the CIA operative, banks catering to illegal immigrants, and Oprah beats George W. by a landslide. From our New York bureau on his maiden voyage with the program, Marcelo Suarez Orozco, co-director of immigration studies at New York University. Kelly Crossley is a social and cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press in Boston. She joins us from our studios in Harvard University. And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, joins us from member station WCLK in Hotlanta. That's Atlanta, Georgia, for those of you who aren't hip enough to know Hotlanta. All right, let's talk quickly about what Newsweek magazine is reporting, and that is a story that we've been following for some time, and they are suggesting that Karl Rove and his lawyers are admitting that, according to Newsweek magazine, that Rove was one of the leaks that told the reporter of the name of the CIA operative that has caused so much of a controversy. We last week talked about whether or not the reporters should be going, in fact, to jail for holding on to this. George Curry, if it's to be believed, this president, more than most, it said, hates leaks. All of them hate them, but he said, it's reported rather, that he hates them with a passion. If it is his right hand, Karl Rove, what does this say?
Well, he doesn't hate leaks. No president hates leaks as long as they're favorable. I think the thing that when you're talking about anonymous sources in general, if you're talking about Washington, and I've been around a while, covered the White House, generally they're skewed toward administration officials. So when you talk about anonymous sources, it's generally not the whistleblowers. It's the administration trying to get their point of view across without being held accountable. That happens time after time. And that's why when you see reference to senior administration officials, oftentimes they can be a cabinet-level person or above, and they want to be able to control the spin without being held accountable.
But any surprise here, George, at all that it would be this level? I mean, Karl Rove, when you put it to Karl Rove, you put it to the president, essentially. It's one and the same mouthpiece, some people say.
But he's a political arm. He's a political object. He's a political genius, quite frankly, for the Republican Party. So I am not surprised at all, because they all want to do the same thing. They want to put their propaganda out, and if they can do it anonymously, that's even better.
Kelly, your thought.
Well, I would add that I think that they didn't think it was going to get to this point. I mean, George is right. This is going on all the time. But who was counting on Judith Miller to say, look, I'm not saying who said anything to me? And we still don't know if Karl Rove was her source in this. But as relates to Matthew Cooper, this is the guy who had the email with Karl Rove. And so, according to the sources, and I don't think they thought it was going to get to the point where Matthew Cooper is saying, well, I might have to go to jail to protect the source, which is appropriate and what he and Judith Miller ought to be doing, in my opinion. But now, here we are, and now it's gotten so ugly, and somebody had to say something. So I think that's the situation he finds himself in.
Marcelo, let me first say welcome to you. And I guess the reason that I keep pushing this, and the surprise to me, is the fact in terms of the name and why it's interesting, in that it said that the operative's husband, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, had been critical of the Bush administration's involvement in the war, and it was said that this is and was to be a slight, a kind of thumb down on one, if you will, and to get it that close to the president is interesting to me.
It certainly is, and someone once said that war is the continuation of politics by other means, and I think this captures the notion that leaks are, in some ways, the continuation of war via other means, political war in this case.
I think it also shows how they're willing to play hardball. They're willing to play hardball. Uh-huh. If you go out there and criticize the president, you're going to pay a price for it, and this is an example of that.
Exactly.
And Kelly, that's the interesting point with this administration, and quite frankly, perhaps more so the Republicans than Democrats of late, and that is the fact, as George says, they are willing to do, in quote, what it takes, political terms, if you will.
Well, that's absolutely true. But now, this is an interesting scenario. The reports have been quite careful to say that Karl Rove did not name Joseph Wilson's wife, which would be a crime. that he said he mentioned that the wife of the ambassador, but he didn't name her. And that's kind of hair splitting to me. But okay, I think that it's if you have the right hand guy committing a crime, this is I don't know where this puts the White House at this point. It seems to me that there's going to have to be some kind of response, and Judith Miller should not be sitting in jail, for one thing.
Well, we'll continue to watch this. This has been ongoing, and we've talked about it throughout. So as it starts to continue to spin, or as it continues to spin, I should say, we will follow it. We felt this was interesting. We were going to get to it last week. Parade Magazine, about a week ago, did an online entertainment poll. And within it, it found that Oprah would beat President Bush if she ran in this mock presidential election. She received 65% of the vote to 35% of the vote to Bush. We didn't necessarily want to talk about that as much as we wanted to talk about whether it's realistic to believe that a woman and a minority could, in fact, win that seat, could be elected in this country to the highest post in the land. Marcelo, do you believe that we have reached a point in today's times where we could potentially see that?
Well, certainly I see there's a decline in of trust in the political class. There is a decline of trust in journalism. And there's some new evidence that suggests that there is an increasing level of trust in our celebrities. So I think that while this opinion poll is certainly not a scientific opinion poll, I think it captures this general process, this general dynamic, whereas young people today, especially, feel much more of an affinity, much more a sense of transparency with certain members of our celebrity class than they do with members of our political class or journalism, other sources of, let's call it, societal authority.
I think you pointed out that it's... Go ahead, Kelly.
I was going to say, I would add that I think it also speaks to fantasy as well. I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the trust, that people are looking for someone to trust, and they think, oh, here's Oprah, she seems warm and fuzzy, and, you know, and but also what continues to happen with regard to Oprah specifically is that people keep putting her aside, outside of the body of black people, outside of the body
of women.
But
that's why I wanted to take it away from this and point out the question, Callie, and take Oprah away from it, because you're right. Oprah has almost, as close as you can in this country, become colorless. Though she found out in London maybe that's not the case when she wanted to buy that bag. But here's the reality. The question for our purposes today is, could an African-American, Latino, or other minority, as well as a female, take it outside of the realm of Oprah, do you believe today, in today's world, they could win?
I think that in this particular climate, Condoleezza Rice would have a good shot. But I'm not certain that even she, in the long haul, wouldn't be accosted with the kinds of comments, statements, you know, that undermine folks who have a good record, but with stuff that has nothing to do with their record and whether or not they have something to contribute. I mean, in the bottom line, race triumphs usually in this country. That's what we have seen over and over and over again. I'd like to think that it's changing, but, you know, I'm not convinced.
George, I'm not sure that credibility and ability will trump, in fact, racism and sexism in this country yet, unfortunately. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't think Condoleezza Rice could get the Republican nomination. I mean, I remember when Colin Powell was riding high, he was such a great figure. He got booed at the Republican convention. So before we talk about whether they can win, they got to get the nomination first. And I think that the one, as was pointed out earlier, this was an online, unscientific poll. And basically, you're talking about celebrity. But there's a big difference when you say just throw somebody's name out there. And once the grueling, battling politics come into play, it becomes a different thing. And finally, people will say one thing to you and vote a different way, and we found that after survey.
Absolutely. Folk lie.
So I don't think it's going to happen. In short, I don't think it's going to happen.
All right. Let's move our attention to something that we also found interesting, and that is competition by banks has become so fierce that we are now seeing lending institutions, financial services, and the like giving support to known illegal immigrants to try to get them within the market. We're also seeing a fight within the Wisconsin state legislature, who's suggesting that they don't see this as necessarily a good idea. Marcella, when you look at the continuation, the growing of what the media has coined the Browning of America, and you look at situations like this, what's your thought?
Well, we're now in the middle of the largest wave of immigration in the history of our country, and in many ways, illegal immigration now has really become the elephant in the room. It affects all kinds of issues, from the education of undocumented alien children to health-related issues to issues relating to jobs. So what we see with this bank initiative is really the tip of a much, much greater iceberg here that has to do with the fact that today in our country there are well over 10 million people without documented status.
I think that's a direct contradiction here. I mean, this in one way we're saying, okay, it's illegal to be here, but on the other hand, we're going to turn away and give you, even the IRS said we'll give you identification numbers since you can't get Social Security numbers. And so, you know, either they're here, you should make the illegals legal, or you should treat them like they're not a citizen. You can't have it both ways, and that's exactly what I see happening here.
That's absolutely correct. And what I found interesting about the case in Wisconsin is that the people who have been offered the mortgages can demonstrate that they've paid taxes, can demonstrate that they're paying bills. And so, you know, as always, we in America back into a policy because we don't want to address what the issues are that surround the policy. So we got to make some choices, as George has said. And rather than make the choices, we sort of just allow business primarily to sort of make policy decisions, political and social policy decisions for the communities, because they can make a profit off of it. And then we find ourselves in a mess.
And we find the IRS is part of this. You know, they claim that the reason they're doing this, I think since about 1997, is this will encourage them to pay taxes. Well, are you supposed to be here or you're not supposed to be here?
And what I worry about, and Marcella, I'm sure you can speak to this as well, is the levels of racism and tension that rise because folks are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm paying taxes and I'm supposed to be here. I'm legally here. And yet people are getting some benefits that should be accorded to me as a citizen. So you've got to make some decisions here.
Certainly. I think there is an urgency to regularize the status of the 10 million plus folk in our midst who work, pay taxes, pay into the Social Security system, by the way. Social Security data suggests that last year in excess of $6 billion went unclaimed in the context of the contributions that undocumented immigrants make into the system. So we can't have it both ways. We can't have an economy that, on the one hand, thrives in immigrant labor and, at the same time, not have the kind of debate in a democracy that is absolutely necessary as to the rights, benefits, obligations of those who are amongst us who do not have a legal permanent resident.
Kelly brings up an interesting point, George Curry, and I'm wondering, when I read this, I initially heard the echo of many African Americans who will suggest to these banks that now that, you know, you put the red carpet out for illegal immigrants, yet historically you've not been able to find a way to make lending money to me a priority or a palatable in a way that I can in turn involve myself in true commerce in this country.
You're right. The red carpet has been extended here, and what African Americans have been extended has been redlining. And I don't want to get into a situation where you're trying to pit African Americans against Latinos. I don't think we should ever get in that position. But you got to have some better ways of saying less extending, certainly mortgages, for example, to people who are having difficulty getting them. And it's often time that you see tension there, and that's why African Americans and Latinos must come together, because you can see a situation like this where they could be pitted against each other.
I agree.
Callie, the thought of, and George echoes what I say so often, we have to be so very careful and not fight each other in the street for the little bit of sliver that's allowed to us. That being said, though, does this also speak to African Americans to suggest that, look, a part of getting the act together and being a part of the system is making sure all of your ducks are in a row. So when you go to the table and say, look, you're even giving to those who, quote, legally should not be obtaining loans, here's my paperwork, here's why I'm ready, here's why I'm deserving.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. And, you know, here's the thing. Those banks that have realized that the communities of African Americans who want to be homeowners well are doing good business. You know, racism does not pay in this instance if people would extend themselves in that way. And this is what the banks were doing in Wisconsin. They realized, hey, there's a community of folks here. They would like to be, you know, own some property. Let's see if we can cater to it. And by the way, we can make a profit. So there's money to be made. Banks should understand that. And at the same time, African Americans also have to speak up and say, hello, I've been here. I'm working. I'm paying taxes. I'm a good risk as well.
All right. Just very quickly, literally, with about 30, 40 seconds to each of you, DiversityInc.com put this out. Nearly 23% of all people born in the United States in 2000 had foreign-born mothers. That's the largest percentage since a wave of immigration more than 90 years ago. Marcelo, and you touched this, we are really in the midst of seeing America change, are we not?
What this data show is that we are really the only democracy in the world where immigration is both history and destiny. If you look at the structure of the second generation, that is the children born in the U.S. of immigrants, not just Latinos, by the way, African immigrants, Afro-Caribbean immigrants, Asian immigrants, that is the fastest growing sector of the U.S. child population. That's the future of our economy, that's the future of our jobs, that's the future of our culture in fundamental ways.
All right, George and Callie, you're going to have to hold that for me. We're going to give Marcelo, since this was his maiden voyage with us, the last word. I thank you all. Greatly appreciate the time and the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.